results in which women were the sole entrepreneur had increased profits, increased business outcomes. When there were multiple entrepreneurs in the household, women's businesses actually suffered. And this is likely because women were diverting their funds to their husband's business.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Well, we might imagine the policies to provide women in low and middle income countries with financial resources or financial services will give them more economic independence. Well, evidence shows that is not necessarily so. So how should we design programs if that's our goal? And why do our best intentions not always deliver the economic empowerment we want? Michaela Rabb is one of a team of researchers who reviewed the evidence about this for J-PAL, and she's here to talk about it now. Michaela, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim.
Now, Michaela, first off, it's no surprise to anyone that women have fewer economic opportunities than men, but how big is this gap?
I wish I had better news for you. So if we're looking at kind of employment outcomes, we see the employment gap is around 25% right now, with some regions that kind of growing all the way up to 50%, especially the Middle East and North Africa. And I think it's really concerning turning to income as well. Women earn around half as much as men globally. And what I'm really concerned about, and I think people have been talking about a lot, has been growing during the pandemic. Women are more likely to lose their jobs and have been slower to recover and return to the workforce.
And is this challenge across development contexts for development economists, for policymakers there? Is this a consistent challenge everywhere?
Yes, I would think so. And not even confined to low and middle income countries. This is even happening here in the United States where I'm based currently. And so it really is a pressing policy and research question. How can we close these gaps to enhance women's economic empowerment?
When we've been talking about many programs on Vox Dev Talks, very often what's happening is that a transfer or a loan is particularly targeted at the woman in the household. Is this going to solve the problem?
So I think there's been this assumption that women knows what's best for their household. And so if you're giving the money to women, they will more likely maybe give it to ensure education for their children or other kind of broader household concerns. Whereas maybe concerns, if you give it to the man, they're spending on alcohol, cigarettes, whatever. So this is kind of where this assumption is rest and why you see a lot of these programs have been targeting women in the first place. But also it can kind of rest on two assumptions. First, that access to a loan or a grant will actually improve household income or women's income. And the second that now resting that the kind of income has actually increased, women actually have control over how those funds are used.
Yes.
And this is where we kind of see our problem, that these two assumptions aren't necessarily holding when we review the evidence.
So let's have a look at that evidence that you reviewed. You looked at 35 studies, I think, in low middle income countries to discover the obstacles that there are for women's economic empowerment. What sort of interventions were you looking at here and what range of countries?
Yes, so correct, Tim. We looked at 35 studies. These were all randomized evaluations or quasi-experimental studies. And it was a range of kind of programs. So financial inclusion programs like microcredit, savings accounts, or cash transfers, but also broader social protection programs like the FAME kind of graduation approach, where it's a bundle of resources set to kind of unlock and target women or people outside of poverty. I see you nodding, so I think a lot of our audience knows about this program. And so these studies came from 20 low and middle income countries really around the world. So we had countries represented like Kenya, Mexico, India, Uganda, and the Philippines. And so it's a really great study to see that across a range of contexts, in very diverse and different settings, we're still seeing some of these challenges play out.
So let's have a look at microcredit first of all, because we've done a couple of episodes where microcredit has been targeted, particularly at women, encouraging them to start a business. What's the theory behind this? How might this lead to empowerment for them?
So I think what's important to acknowledge is that people living in poverty are just as entrepreneurial as people in Silicon Valley, that they have great ideas. But the challenge is that they don't really have your venture capital funds to get an easy grant or investment. And so what microcredit does is target this credit gap and failure of these existing markets to help low-income entrepreneurs really kickstart their business and as a way to transition them out of poverty. And I think particularly for women where they actually might have an even more difficult time accessing formal employment opportunities, entrepreneurship can be really transformative. For instance, if you're able to kind of own your own business at home and you're able to balance both the demands of your business and your household, taking care of children, all within the confines of your home, that flexibility can be really important, particularly for women.
Where we started with this, women earn half as much as men. So the first goal for this has to be to increase their labor income, does it?
And unfortunately, going back to that first assumption, no. We're seeing very limited impacts on income, Tim. So 15 of the studies that we looked at had some sort of measured business outcomes. Only 6 of the 15 actually found that access to microcredit or savings groups had some small impact on business outcomes. For instance, women more likely to start a business, running a business for a longer time. So yes, these are important outcomes to acknowledge. Yet, none of these studies found that this actually translated to increases in women's income. And that's what's disappointing here. I don't want to be the bearer of all bad news. So it is important to call out that some of these studies did find positive impacts on household consumption, household spending, or assets. And these could be indicators of greater income in the household. But in the kind of traditional measures of women money in your account or how much they reported, we weren't moving the needle there. Additionally, we also saw that there were positive impacts on women's work. So women were working more. And eventually, this may lead to more earned income that maybe was not measured during the time of that study.
Is one of the things that we run up against here gender norms in some places that restrict women's opportunities for social independence or economic independence from their husbands? Is that undermining this type of intervention?
You're right in the nose. We're seeing these limited impacts. The question is why? And one interesting study that have been coming out is testing the role of gender norms in understanding what may drive these limited impacts. So a very exciting study reanalyzed findings from microcredit programs in India, Ghana, and Sri Lanka. And they found that women entrepreneurs were not as successful as their male counterparts. And why was that the case? So what they actually found reanalyzing the data is that households in which women were the sole entrepreneur had increased profits, increased business outcomes. When there were multiple entrepreneurs in the household, women's businesses actually suffered. And this is likely because women were diverting their funds to their husband's business.
Going back decades now, when we think about transfers, for example, if we start off from Progressa onwards, transfers are very often given to the woman in the household. Do we have evidence that this increases their economic independence?
And not necessarily. So in some cases, we found that these sort of programs did move the needle on decision-making power. Like you said, a lot of these kind of cash transfer programs from the onset have been targeting women with this assumption that it'll be better for the whole household. But only 4 of the 15 studies that we looked at that measured household decision-making power found positive impacts on women's decision-making power. And this may be in part because the studies themselves were having limited or inconsistent effects on income. So for instance, if microcredit program was not even improving income in the first place, how would we expect that to improve decision-making power if we need women to have, there needs to be greater income overall to change the dynamics of who has control over that extra income?
We've got some discouraging news from many of the studies that you've analysed. So I have to ask, are there better ways to do this? Are there better ways to provide the payments? Should we provide more support to women? Should we provide bank accounts? Should we provide financial education so that they have more decision-making power over what's done with the money? They have more financial independence as a result?
Exactly. And I think for us, what we want to drive home from this policy brief, it's not just a closed door. Maybe the ways that they've traditionally done these programs have not been working. But we do have some exciting findings to show what does work. And so, as you mentioned, promising ways to design these programs is first giving women direct control over use of the funds through a digital transfer like mobile money or through direct deposit. And we found across several studies that programs that directly transferred funds to women had more positive and promising impacts than programs that were less direct. The second thing I want to highlight is the role of commitment savings accounts or other costly ways to access it. So I think commitment savings accounts have often been lauded for maybe tying one's hands to limit funds for savings. But in terms of tying one's hands, also think about how you're tying other people's hands to your family. So for women, this is really important in that not only are they kind of maybe improving their own savings, but also restricting maybe their husbands or other family members from accessing this fund as well, and gives them, again, a bit more flexibility and privacy over how their own resources are used.
Now, we're thinking about this in the context of programs that have a goal to increase women's economic empowerment. Is this only relevant in those contexts, or should we be always thinking about this?
No. And so I think even going back to that initial question, why are we targeting women in the first place? So yes, the first goal obviously is important, empowering women to be active agents in their lives. And I don't want to downplay that at all. But there also are positive spillovers within these programs. So if we believe the assumption that women may be more likely to target spending to their children or other household members, then this could be a really important way to encourage broader development of the family.
We often fall into the trap of trying to think of a universal theory of how we can help people everywhere. Is it possible to design some kind of universal toolkit for women's economic empowerment, or is it more complicated than that, Michaela?
Don't we wish? I think for me, it's no one size fits all approach, especially because gender norms and gender context are so context specific. I would even argue it's so household specific. And so while we're generalizing across these different studies and we are seeing general lessons appear, that one study does not capture the nuances of experiences that women face and the different contexts in which they live. So I think general takeaways that we're finding is that, yes, digital transfers can be really promising, but they also require that infrastructure in place. And in many cases, that is still burgeoning and emerging in many low and middle income countries. The second is we're looking at savings accounts. So yes, we're making it very costly to access, which could have benefits for improving empowerment outcomes. But it also means that you might have to wait a bit of time and it's a little bit more inconvenient to get your money in. So emergencies do happen. And so I think for us, what we're really thinking about is how important it is to understand the context in which you operate, what those gender norms are, and how these existing programs coexist or even conflict with what these kind of existing norms are in that context. And finally, I think it's really important, while many of the programs that we looked at are workarounds to programs. So, you know, maybe women are concerned about sharing funds with their household, so they're hiding money. But can we think about ways that shift gender norms more broadly, that encourage cooperation and coordination amongst households, and really reshift power dynamics such that men and women in the household have equal playing field and can negotiate and talk about how they want to spend their money jointly?
That's some great insights, but certainly a lot of work to be done in this area, isn't there, Michaela? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's been a pleasure chatting today.
If you want to read the policy brief, I suggest you do. It's called Designing Financial Services and Social Protection Programs to Enhance Women's Economic Empowerment. And you can find that on the JPEL website. The authors are Seema Jayachandran, Michaela Rabb, and Wei Chang. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, and the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, if you do miss an episode, or if you just want to read some of the papers or articles about the papers that we feature, you can find more information at voxdev.org.